Blog Talk Radio.
Take a licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer radio show, brought to you by Tractor Supply, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken-related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated, but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, and National Spokesperson for the USDA Biosecurity for Birds Program. Today is Wednesday, September 11th, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, we welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Hey, be sure to visit us on our website, brand new, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Tractor Supply.
Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com. Or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing.
Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your Chicken Fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com.
Mount Healthy Hatcheries has been a hatching tradition for over 80 years. Home of the healthiest chicks, Mount Healthy Hatcheries offers a wide selection of bantams, turkeys, guineas, ducks, pheasants, and of course, meat birds and layers. Order online at mounthealthy.com, that's mthealthy.com, or give them a call at 1-800-451-5603. Don't forget to ask about their free bonus chicks offer. Mount Healthy Hatcheries, home of the healthiest chicks.
Established in 1957, GQF has become the name to trust when it comes to quality products and superior customer service. GQF offers a wide range of poultry products, including incubators, brooders, feeders, waters, and much, much more. Give them a call at 912-236-0651 or visit them online at gqfradio.com. That's GQFradio.com.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
All righty. Thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We're so glad you tuned in today on this second Wednesday of September. Yes, it happens to be the anniversary of 9/11. So sometime during the day, we ask that you just take a moment of silence and think about all the people that have been affected, all the people that lost their lives there, and just have a little reflection about that day and what it meant for yourself, your family. Maybe you knew somebody that lost a loved one in that tragic day. But we ask that you take a moment today and remember and reflect on that, what you were doing back when that occurred. I had a previous career. No, I have not always been the Chicken Whisperer. This has been my full-time gig now for 4.5 years. And but prior to that, prior to what I was doing when 9/11 happened, I was a firefighter paramedic full-time and for about 8 years. And then I got a little burned out doing that at the busiest service in the state of Georgia in inner city Atlanta. And then started it ended up being a very successful business, providing health and safety training for corporate America, IBM, Coca-Cola, GE, Georgia Pacific, some big boys. And I was actually doing a first aid CPR and heart defibrillator class for General Electric. And we took a break. No one had come in to interrupt to tell us what was going on. We just took a break. And I suspect that break was probably around 9:15 or 9:30. And we walked out, and there was the TV kind of out in the lobby area. Very nice office building, wow. And saw exactly what was happening. So, GE, that was the GE Power headquarters. CEO was right there in that building. So we released them to go do whatever they needed to do based on whatever business they had to do with the situation. And but it was Jen was actually in college, and she was working that particular time, I think, at a daycare because she was doing her clinicals, and she worked part-time in a daycare. She was an early childhood education major and got her bachelor's degree in that. So I remember trying to call her. The cell phones were busy, couldn't get through, things like that, being glued to the television. So it's just crazy. But nonetheless, take a moment today. Reflect back on that, what you were doing, where you were at, what were you feeling, the progress we've made, if any, since then. And especially if you need friends or family members. Christmas Chief in the chat room said her brother-in-law was supposed to be in the Twin Towers that day but got sent to another part of the city to do electrical work. So that was ended up being a blessing. I did a lot of training as a former paramedic and firefighter regarding 9/11. This show's not about that, but I did a lot of training with healthcare providers regarding using that as a scenario and as a training tool. And it gets kind of personal being a former firefighter and paramedic, but I don't care who you ask, there were a lot of heroes that died that day that shouldn't have. It was a unique situation that never had happened in the history of mankind. The scene was not safe, and I feel that if it happened again, God forbid, that things would be done differently as far as the rescue plan. I was responsible for a lot of the 2006 Olympics in Atlanta. I was on many committees there through the EMS departments, going through different scenarios with the Olympics. And, you had the Olympic bombing that year, which I was at, 2006. And I was just looking around going, all this months of training out the door when that bomb went off. And I was sitting there looking at people run around like a chicken with their head cut off. Nothing was really, no implemented plan was followed. I mean, it wasn't a complete disaster or a cluster, but it definitely could have gone a lot better. And so, but I guarantee if you talk to the head honcho up in New York at the fire department, they'd do things differently today if it happened again, I guarantee you. All those heroes that were lost and killed, and a lot of people justify that by saying things like,
well, you know, they were saving lives. And when we did training on this situation, we said, well, I guess that depends on what your definition of saving a life is all about, right? If your definition of saving a life is a fireman standing in a stairwell, going, get out, and waving his hands, then maybe he did save a lot of lives. If your definition of saving a life is having a dead patient and shocking him back to life with a defibrillator and starting IVs and cardiac drugs and things like that, is that your definition of saving a life? So it depends, boils down to what your definition, whether it be a medical definition or just your personal definition of what saving a life is. If those 500-600 first responder deaths, were they there saving lives? What were they, you know, was it warranted? Was the scene not safe? Should they have not been in there? And it just depends on a lot of times your personal views, but we've done a lot of training on what ifs, and I guarantee you things would be done differently today if it happened again, and so we wouldn't lose another 500 firefighters. Did those 500 firefighters save 500 lives? Again, it goes back to saving, you know, back to what your definition of saving a life is. And like I said, after being a career paramedic and firefighter and trainer, and training a lot of corporate and even a lot of nurses, a lot of doctors, and other EMTs, paramedics, I was a training center director for the American Heart Association. And we have drilled this till we were blue in the face, and it just boils down to that. So very, very, very interesting. And I spent a lot of time in that field, and still, it's a horrible situation. And I can tell you, because I've talked to them, I've talked to one of my calls I had when I was a paramedic at Atlanta was an Atlanta police officer that was shot and killed, and talking with his wife after the fact and her time of grief and whatnot. And, you know, she really could care less that he maybe died a hero. What if there's a statue for him? What if there's a plaque now for him and honoring him as a hero? She can't cuddle with a statue at night. She can't hold a statue at night. She could care less about that plaque. She wants her husband. So same thing goes. I think when we talk about this in extents with all the firemen that have lost their lives, the rescuers, the heroes, you know, their families can say, yes, he died what he loved doing. He was a hero, and there may be a plaque for him, but by golly, I can't cuddle with that plaque. My kids can't go fishing with that plaque, you know. And so heroes, yes, but I'm sure the families wish they would still be here instead of having a plaque stating that they're a hero. So, you know, one of those things, and you know, being in that field, we've talked about it with blue in the face, training, what ifs, what it should have, would have, could have, all that stuff. But I'm telling you, take some time today, think about it, and think about where you're at, what you were doing. If you have loved ones, give them a call. Let them know you're thinking about them, especially if they were affected personally by what happened on 9/11 many, many years ago. So today we've got a great show. It's the second Wednesday of the month, which means it is all about quail with the quail lady. Alexandra Douglas is joining us today. And she's going to recap a little bit from last month. In fact, I've got great news. But today she's going to recap about last month. She's also going to cover the history of the quail and an overview of other species of quail. And she may even touch and start on quail housing, what's required. If you're looking at starting some quail and you want to know about what kind of housing is required for them, whether it be a small or large operation, you're going to get that today. So we ask that you pull out that Chicken Whisperer notebook. Get that pen and paper ready, and get ready to learn all about quail today. I know that she's in the process of releasing a second book, or maybe she already released the second book, and now she's working on a third. I'm sure she'll tell us all about that when we bring her live here on the show talking about quail. And how cool is that? But the good news is, because, man, I was like, you were on a month ago. And, you know, that's you know, people interested in quail, and that's a long gap there before we start learning about it again. So I told her, she's got a lot of information. She's already on her second book, maybe even her third book, all about quail. And so there's no lack of information. So we were talking yesterday, and I said, hey, you need to consider coming on twice a month. Most of our guests do a minimum of twice a month. You know, Richard Friedenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine, the Wednesday Show, Garden Wise Living with Arlena, twice a month, Dr. Bridget McRae, PhD, twice a month. We are fortunate to have Peter Brown, the chicken doctor, every Monday. And so she said, well, she could definitely work that into her schedule. So I'm proud to announce that we will now have Alexandra Douglas, the Quail Lady, twice a month, the second and fourth Wednesday of every month. How awesome is that? So make sure, if you don't think about it today, take some notes, go out and buy you a spiral notebook, put Quail Lady on the front, CW Show on the front, whatever, all about quail, and have it for your note-taking, because this is just kind of like a college course, if you will. We've got a textbook, which is Alexander's book, and we'll try to post the link again on our Facebook page and here in the chat room about how you can purchase her book, because throughout the show, she'll say, hey, I'm referring to page, or you can find more about this on page. And so it's pretty cool. So we hope you do that. Hey, I hope you have had a great weekend. Let me tell you, it's been fun here. I've been fishing just about every day with the little man, and we've caught some big whoppers. You've probably seen them. I post some of the fish we've caught on our Facebook page and Twitter page, and we're just having a great time. I think I posted the other day on our Facebook page that, you know, what we do, because, you know, he's 26 months, 27 months, he's a little over two, and so to just sit there and concentrate on that bobber and whatnot and cast, no, it's not happening at that age. So he takes a few trucks, a few tractors, and he sits there with Daddy, and I do the concentration and the baiting and the fishing, and then whenever I hook one, I'll do two or three reels, turn that reel two or three times, make sure the hook's set, say, Caleb, it's your turn, and he gets so excited, he'll drop his trucks, he'll stand up, And he'll reel the fish in. So it's a father and son venture, and he loves to do that. Pull the fish out of the water, and his eyes get real big, and he already can point to say, where are the fins? You know, where's the tail? Where's the eyes? Where's the lips? And where are the gills? And he points right to him. He's such a trooper, but we have so much fun. We're having a good time. But one day, you know, he's dropped about three tractors, a little, you know, the matchbox car things, into the lake. And the other day he dropped, I think, two tractors in the lake, and then I dropped my glasses, my reading glasses, and they hit the dock, and then I heard this thunk, and I'm like, well, what was that? I reached down and get my glasses, and one of the lenses had popped out of my glasses and flew over into the lake. So I'd had them for about 3 years. It was probably time for an upgrade, but I really downgraded, because those were my real prescription glasses from the doctor, and I went to Walmart and bought me some of these just generic glasses, and they're not as good. They don't, you know, they're just one specific distance. That's it. Mine were much better that I used. So I'm going to have to go to the doctor again. I don't know what my prescription was. I think it was three. I think I turned 40 and said, Jen, I need to go to the eye doctor. I'm getting old. And so I got these cheap old Walmart, big all they are is magnifying glasses you put in front of your eyes on a glass frame. But they work a little bit, but we've had time. Christmas Chick says, can't wait till Lily is old enough to play tea party or dress up and we get to see those picture parties. Hey, you know, that's what it's all about. I'll have no problems playing tea party or dress up with Lily. That'll be great. And I will post pictures of that as well. If I have to, if Caleb ever wants to go to Walmart dressed up like a superhero with a cape, I'll have my cape on too and we'll walk right into Walmart like it's everyday currents. That's what being a daddy is all about, and I love it. I should have started sooner, I guarantee. I was never really a kid person, but now, you know, now that I've got to, I really wish I'd have started this. So if you're listening to this and you're not a kid person, like I wasn't per se, you know, I could care less if we ever had kids. Not now. Let's wait. Let's enjoy life. And, you know, it was just me and Jen were married for about 10 years before we decided to have kids. We enjoy that time together, but it's I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. Let me tell you, it's I wish I started when I was 30 instead of 40. I guarantee I do. But nonetheless, I'm taking advantage of it every single day with my kids, and I hope you do too. All right, let's get over here to the phone lines, and we've got Alexandra Douglas, the Quail Lady, coming on, talking all about quail today. So let me scroll down here and to the switchboard. And let's give her a big chicken whisperer welcome. Well, let's try that again. There we go. A little bit of delay there. Hey, Alexander, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Yes.
I have a lot to talk about today, so we better get started on this lecture, I would say. Lecture on
right
the ahead. Internet. We have a lot to talk about since it's been a month already. I'm very happy that we can do this two times a month, so I don't have to go.
I am too. I was like, part of me was like, oh my gosh, it's already been a month. But part of me is like, you know, last week, week before, I'm like, is this week she's coming on? Next week? And then, you know, when's the Quail Lady coming back on? I'm like, wow, we got a lot of information. And when you think about it, it's only with the holiday breaks we take here. It's really only ends up being about 20 shows a year, and holy cow, that's not a lot of material, and you know, a lot of time for all the information that you know and you have and you stuff into your book. So speaking of books, I know you've got one out because I've got one, and following your Facebook page when I can. It's you've already had the other one done and printing, or you're starting on your third, or give us an update.
Well, the second one was published on Saturday. It's about hatching and incubating. It's called Hatching and Incubating and Hatching the American Way. It's an in-depth guide to incubating and hatching from chickens, ducks, geese, to all the way to rat types, emu, rhea, and cassowaries. And I put tips and tricks on what I do, what other people do, and I use I added tips from farmers from the 1900s, from the 1800s, on what they do that actually work today, that what people are doing today that actually work. So there's little stories, and it's pretty unique. It's a shorter book than Copernicus Revolution. It's not 400 pages, but it was a success. I enjoyed writing it, and it's out. And there's a black and white copy because some people wanted to take notes in it, and they were kind of scared to take notes in an all-color book. But I always tell, and like, if it doesn't matter, I'm a picture person, I'm a visual learner, I will take notes in anything. If it's a color book, most of my college textbooks have notes in it regardless of color or black and white. So, you know, the prices differ between black and white and color, but the two versions are exactly the same other than, you know, black and white and color. They're both on Amazon and on the CreateSpace account that I have, and I can post a link on your wall for that. There's a link on my farm page as well. I am working on my third book. My writing muse has kicked in, so that may come out in a couple months or sooner. I write fast, so whatever my mind is set, you know, I will write. So today we're going to discuss, we're going to do an overview of last month, because I myself, you know, if I'm learning about something a month ago, you forget, and you don't want to, sometimes you don't want to, you know, listen. I'm sorry to say, sometimes you don't want to listen to a radio show. You want to listen to the lecture on a review. So we're going to learn about the origin of words again, and I'm going to add a few more things to that. We're going to learn about the history of Copernicus from the Copernicus Revolution, and we're going to learn about the history of quail in general. We're going to learn about several different species of quail, and we're going to learn about the start of housing, and we'll finish if we cut it short today. If time cuts short, then we'll continue in 2 weeks or before.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Yeah. The next time, I have to figure out the exact date for that. But you know, we know that the word quail is quite vague. There are many vocabulary meanings behind it, and when in context, there's a confusion on what you're referencing it to. If we are talking about a bird, we need to know what species of bird. There's just not one quail in the world, after all. If that's the case, then there'll be just one show, and that's going to be boring. So, you know, we have when I've been researching the word Copernicus and the word quail, and we keep getting the same definition for the Copernicus, which they define it as a small game bird reared to produce oven-ready birds and for their eggs. And this drives me crazy, because I type in quail, and that's the first word that pops up. Yes, it is the most popular bird there is, but it's misleading because the Coturnix is only one species of quail. It does not mention, the definition does not mention that about all the other species.
Uh-oh. Hello, we lost you. Okay, let me check here in the chat room because I don't hear you. Okay, there she goes. She's calling back in. She got disconnected. Here we go.
Yeah, I got a farm disconnection. That's what happens if
Welcome
you live
back.
In the middle of nowhere.
Welcome back. No problem.
All right. So we have, you know, the definition of Coturnix. It does not mention that all species are not used for meat and eggs. You know, there are some more ornamental quail than others. You don't want to eat a valley quail, for example. They're so pretty, but still people hunt them. I mean, it's all preference after all. If you consider all the birds that are galliforms and most often are called quail, there are more than 45 species of quail that are known to science. This does not include all the subspecies. For example, we have bobwhites. You think of bobwhites of only, you know, those brown quail you see in the wild and everything. Well, if you look more in depth, the bobwhite quail has 24 subspecies. So that makes 24 plus subspecies of the bobwhite quail. So it gets very, very in depth. Now, in the 14th century, we have the quail, the definition of the quail as meaning to cower. And the former of the old quail, which also is called quail, comes from the medieval Latin word coacula, which also is the imitation of the bird's grating cry. So that's where pretty much the word quail comes from, and that's why it's a generic word. But so how do we define the word quail? It is important to know what we are talking to when we are referring to quail. So that is the purpose of an in-depth discussion on the origin and why quail are called quail. So if we research the term quail, we get two definitions. And this is if you type it in Google and the definition comes up. We get a small, short-tailed, old-world game bird resembling a small partridge. So it has the brown camouflage plumage. And then we get a small, medium-sized New World game bird, which has a distinctive facial marking. So the bobwhite has that distinctive facial marking. So the origin behind that, then, as I mentioned before, we have the medieval Latin word coacula, and then the old French word quail. So we get the Middle English word quail. So history is important for quail as well, which makes me a bird nut too, but that's okay. So the definition above that, so to pronounce quail is how I'm pronouncing it. K-W-A-L is how you would pronounce it, so Q-U-A-I-L. And then we get, so a better definition of this indistinct yet important term would be a collective name for several genera of mid-sized birds generally considered in the order Galliforms. So as I mentioned in last month's radio show, we have the scientific classification that the quail are in the kingdom Animalia, the phylum of Chordata, the class of Aves, and the order of Galliforms. So there's still misinformation on the World Wide Web, of course, in older textbooks of the definition of quail, specifics on breeds and species, and confusion among the two families of quail, the New World quail and the Old World quail. But quail are game birds, and, you know, so we have to go further on that. The true definition of a game bird is a bird that is typically hunted for food. These birds are not domesticated and considered wild. All quail have these tendencies, and although many species have been domesticated, such as our Japanese quail, the Coturnix, which I describe in Copernicus' revolution. The budding quail, Dexcalifactoria chinensis, which are also known as the Chinese blue-breasted quail, the king quail, and in the UK they refer to the budding quail as the Chinese painted quail, the same term for the same bird. Now, the quail should not be mistaken with chicken. Chicken are domesticated birds, but they are also in the order of Galliformes. But they are completely different. The chicken originated from the red jungle fowl, and many breeds have been created since. Chickens have breeds such as the Silkie and Marans. Those are always the two breeds that pop up in my head, so I always, those are my two examples. They're my first breed, so that's how it goes, other than the Seabrights, but the Seabrights hate me, so that's another story. So each, in the chickens, we have breeds and varieties within them. So these varieties are color mutations. So the Silkies are not only white, but they can come in blue, black, buff, and porcelain, and many other mixtures in between. Chickens are from one family, the Physiandia. So I would like to talk about breed versus species. Now, quail terminology is very different than chicken. They are more wild than domesticated. Even though, you know, we do have the domesticated quail and we do refer to them as domesticated, they're still wild. If you put them outside compared to chicken, they will go away. They will fly away. Will fly or walk away, at least. They don't free range well, or a hawk will get them. They're very small. There are more wild than domesticated, and although many of the old world quail are domesticated, they do not have breeds. Instead, we refer to them as species. It's a pet peeve of mine when people say, oh, what breed of quail do I have? And then I have to explain, well, they are species, and it makes me look like the bad guy when I have to say that. But I like to correct people in a nice way, at least. Within each species, there can be a subspecies. Within the species and subspecies, there are varieties, which are color mutations. For example, the Copernicus quail has 8 species. We have the common quail and the Japanese quail, the Copernicus copernicus and the Copernicus japonica. But those two intermingled in the past, and I will, in the history portion of this radio section, I will talk about that. Okay. But I wanted to start that off. We have the stubble quail, the Copernicus pectoralis, the New Zealand quail, which is extinct, but still, extinct birds are as important as the non-extinct. We have the rain quail, the Copernicus coromandelica, the African harlequin quail, the Copernicus delagorai, and the brown quail, and the Canary Islands quail, the Copernicus gomari, which is extinct, and they only have the fossil form of this one, but it is as important because it's in our history. So that is the Copernicus quail, 8 species, even though in Copernicus Revolution, you know, there's 410 pages of just the Copernicus japonica. That is how quail are very, there's a lot of information on quail because there's a lot of quail to discuss. So within these species, there are color mutations known as varieties. They can be either called as varieties or color mutations because we have to mix and match colors to get colors. The Japanese quail, I always use them as example because they are my favorite. They have over 30 color varieties. Not all of them are available to the public. Many of them are in research laboratories and universities and labs and being studied profusely. The color varieties and species get complicated. However, with a simple understanding that they're very different than chicken, it gets easier from here on out. You just have to understand that, you know, these are not like chicken. Some animal husbandry of quail is similar to chicken, but not all.
Mm-hmm.
But if you understand that quail are different, then it'll be easy to, you know, easier to raise them and easier to understand them, and that the knowledge is important and that you can respect them more, that they're not mm-hmm. just throwaway birds. They're not that they just like, I'm going to say just like chickens this time, but they can be pets and they have many uses as well as food. I use them. I use most as a food source, but I do have my ornamental birds too. We have Old World quail and New World quail. These are the two different families of quail, completely different families. The Old World quail are found in the family Physiandidae. Many of the common larger species are farm-raised for table food or egg consumption, just like the Coturnix japonica, the Japanese quail, which is in Coturnix Revolution. Old World quail, small, plump territorial birds. They are seed eaters, but they will take insects and similar small prey. They nest on the ground and are capable of short, rapid bursts of flight. The common and Japanese Coturnix, which, the Coturnix Revolution book discusses this in detail, they're the quail that are both raised for table meat and to produce eggs. Some varieties are readily hunted and are often artificially incubated and hatched on game farms or to supplement wild populations. Now, with Old World quail, when I say supplement wild populations, there are varieties of the Japanese quail that are more flighty or jumpy than others. For example, the jumbo Coturnix or the Pharaoh, they're more docile than, for example, the Tibetan. The Tibetan were originally made as a dog hunting bird, you know, like they were kind of made for like bobwhites. And in the UK, they call them the British Range. Now, we have, there are many, many, many Old World quail, and there's a huge list of Old World quail. Most of them are the ones that I talk about because many of the Old World quail are in the Coturnix genus. The most popular are the Japanese quail. Japanese quail and the budding quail are the most popular. The African harlequin quail are becoming quite popular in the U.S. About a couple years ago, they were introduced back into the U.S., and they are in between the size of a Japanese quail and a budding quail, and they have similar characteristics as both. They're better housed as a budding quail, but they breed as prolifically as a Coturnix Japanese quail. They are a subspecies of the Coturnix. We have the New World quail, which are found in the family of the Odontophoridae. They are short-winged, necked, and tailed. Their bills are shorter than the Old World quails, and they're slightly curved and serrated. Their legs are short and powerful, and they lack the spurs that many Old World galliforms have. Partridges are also part of the Old World galliforms, and they have little tiny spurs, so that's when I compare to the lack of spurs, because Coturnix don't really have spurs. They have little stubs for where spurs are located, but they don't have spurs. Mm-hmm. They are capable of bursts of strong flight, but they do prefer to walk and run from danger. They do fly, the New World quail do fly, and I always have somebody escaping and flying on the top of the tree, and it's really hard to get them down. So they do roost, they have the roosting capabilities compared to the Old World quail, which are more ground dwellers. So their plumage varies from adult to spectacular. Some birds are very ugly, and some birds are very pretty. It just depends on the species. They have to be more camouflaged with the wild so that predators don't get them, because New World quail are more found in the wild. And you can still find them in the wild. Like Bob White's can still be found in the wild, and people, FWC and other agents are still repopulating areas with Bob White's. In other states, the California Valley quail, the Gambel's quail, the Texas the blue-scaled quail are still found in little areas as well in the wild. So they have to be camouflaged to their location so that they don't get hunted down by predators and that they can repopulate naturally. So the New World quail have many species and subspecies. They're a very diverse group. Like I said, the bobwhite quail alone has over 24 subspecies with them. But compared to the Old World quail, which they're more, they can be more docile and you can train them better than the New World quail. The New World quail are more shy, diurnal birds. So they're more flighty. It's really hard to tame.
Oh, okay, let's see what we got here. Sounds like she may have disappeared again, so give me just a second to get back over here to the switchboard. And, yes, let's go ahead and take a real quick commercial break, and we'll be back right after this with more All About Quail with the Quail Lady. Stay tuned.
When you need an incubator, think Brensey, the incubation specialist. Brensey has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensey.com. Brensey spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensey.com or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg handlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brensey, technology you can trust. Pictures of chickens on aprons are common across America, but picture a chicken wearing an apron and you'll probably get a good chuckle. Laugh if you must, but nothing protects hens better than the Hen Saver Hen Apron. Hen Saver Hen Aprons protect your hens from the damage caused by an overly affectionate rooster and may even provide protection from an unexpected hawk attack. Hen Savers come in several different sizes to fit both bantam and standard-sized hens and roosters. Colors include camo, denim, navy, brown, khaki or black, and soon pink. Crazy K Farm is expanding its already colorful Hen Saver collection to include the color pink. A portion of their sales will be donated to organizations that fund breast cancer research and awareness. Order your Hen Saver aprons today at hensaver.com. That's hensaver.com.
Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937. Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry. From rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams, Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com.
How would you like a punch in the beak?
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. So that little cutoff there with the quail lady, there's some storms around and about her area, and you know how these new phones today, they will break in, whether there's a amber alert or a silver alert or a warning, some type of weather warning, and my understanding is that her phone was letting her know there's a tornado warning
not where she's at. We would definitely let her go and have her tend to herself and her animals. But Alexandra said it's not at this point anywhere close to be alerted to, but it cut her off when the emergency tone came through. So you are back live, Alexandra. Thank you so much.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. These new phones are driving me nuts. The phone just turned off. All right. So where we were at, I wanted to talk about the New World quail, that they do roost in trees. And see, the phone drove me nuts. So I'm getting off track now. That, you know, that sometimes they do get out of your reach and do roost in the trees, but they do generally feed mainly on the ground. They do take in insect seeds, vegetation, and other forage as well. The reason I like to talk about their natural diet is because although you can feed them, you know, the game bird starter that, you know, for supplements, you can go with the forage and other goodies to increase protein and to keep with their natural diet, because they do produce better when you feed. Birds produce better in general when you do feed them what they like. And desert species in particular consume a lot of seeds. The northern bobwhite is the most common New World quail that we know of. We have a lot of New World quail. The most popular is the bobwhite quail. We have the California Valley quail, the blue scaled, and people are liking lately those Mearns quail, which I will talk about later on. I'm trying to speed up a little bit so I can talk about housing and history. With the words, where should budding quail be categorized at? I spoke about this very briefly last time. Let's talk about the most misunderstood little quail for a second. Budding quail are the Chinese blue-breasted quail. They are not in the Coturnix genus. In many books, it says they are Coturnix. They are not. They are not New World quail. They are a unique type of quail in the Old World quail. Their name budding quail is misleading. The true budding quail are hemipodes, and hemipodes are birds that lack a hind toe and crop. And they are in a small family of birds, the Turnicidae, which resemble but are unrelated to the quail of Phasianidae and inhabit the warm grasslands of Asia, Africa, Europe, and Australia. And there's 16 species and 2 genera of these hemipodes. The true budding quail are small running birds which avoid flying, and the female is more brightly colored of the sexes and initiate the courtship. What's really cool about these birds is that both sexes cooperate in the building of a nest, but only the male incubates the eggs and tends the young, similar to the emu. The eggs hatch after an incubation period of 12 to 13 days, and the young are able to fly within 2 weeks of hatching. Within the Turnicidae family, we get many more species. This is what people are like, oh, I have budding quail. But, you know, budding quail are not really budding quail. They got their name because soldiers would bring them home, and people were like, oh, they're cute as a budding. And so that's how they got budding quail. They are Excalifactoria canesis. They're in a different genus altogether. And aviculturists are still fighting over the terms, and it's just, it's a crazy world of budding quail, and there's wars among groups for this little tiny misunderstood quail. Now, I would like to, words get a little bit boring, so I'm going to talk about the history of quail, and we have... Let's see. always been used as a staple food source in many cultures, and it is a matter of time before our culture uses quails as self-sufficiency source, especially with the Coturnix. Egyptians needed a protein source to give them energy while building the Great Pyramids, and a typical Egyptian would be growing wheat, fruit, and raised quail as their meat source. I was looking at a typical Egyptian diet, and there was a picture of quail, like they're actually, you know, butchering a quail along with their fruits and veggies. So that was really interesting. They would actually establish large farms in order to breed them in large numbers. It was their actual protein source, their staple food. Like we would have rice, they would have quail. Quail were so common in Egypt that they had their own hieroglyphs. They were in many writings of the Egyptians. These days, Egyptian might not be widely spoken anymore, but the quail are still an important source of food for both the meat and eggs in a lot of countries. And quail eggs are, in fact, arguably more nutritious than chicken. Mm-hmm. And that is quail in general. Now, I want to talk about the Coturnix, because Coturnix have been in our society for centuries as well, and they are the perfect staple food. And as, you know, as other species, the Egyptians, I believe the Egyptians did use bob whites in their diaries, in their hieroglyphs. You can see hieroglyphs of both bob white shapes and Coturnix shapes. So it is believed that both types of quail were used as their protein source, and I believe some were fast growing and some probably were used as their egg source more than meat. But now that we have dual purpose Coturnix, the jumbos, we can actually have those as our dual purpose birds instead of using bob whites, although bob whites have good tasting meat as well. The Coturnix had exemplary growth characteristics and have the ability to stay healthy in tight quarters. So the Egyptians were able to breed them in large numbers, and today we are able to breed them in large numbers too, which makes them a wonderful self-sufficiency source. Now, in Coturnix Revolution, I go in depth with the importance of names of the Coturnix. And the Japanese quail especially, the reason that we come up with Japanese quail is because the early American settlers who raised the Coturnix, they knew them as Bible quail. And later on, they were imported to Germany and became the German quail. And lastly, in World War II, they were imported from Japan, and that was the last known importation. So that's why they ended up being the Japanese quail. And after that, they were highly researched in labs. So we get the Coturnix japonica, but they are also known as the king's quail, the emperor's quail, Tsar's quail, the Mediterranean quail, the Holy Land quail, and the Nile quail, all of which apply to the same Coturnix quail. So why do we have all these different names for one bird? Why can't we all agree with the Japanese quail? Well, it's because culture permeated. We had this, we started with Egypt, and we know that Coturnix were depicted in murals and used as an important source for food for the Egyptians as their staple food. There are Bible references and Roman writings substantiating the Egyptian records. And the wild quail would migrate from Asia and fly over Europe, finally reaching Alexandria, Egypt. So culture has been permeating. We have the spread. We then find out that there's a spread of culture to China and Japan as China began to domesticate Copernicus 400 years earlier than Japan, and then 1,000 years earlier than today. We have the first evidence of domestication from Japan recorded from the 13th century. There was a lot of cultural exchange, so that explains why we have all these different names. But the most understood name is the Japanese quail, especially since Japanese students were taught by Chinese monks. So we also have the culture furthered as Copernicus migrated. Now, Copernicus used to be smaller than they are today, basically because of evolution itself. But they were found in many locations, and the wild European Copernicus, classified as Copernicus Copernicus, were distributed throughout Asia, Africa, and Europe, and along with their subspecies. The Japanese quail, which we know today, are considered to be different species than the Copernicus Copernicus, but they are in fact now considered to be identical due to the past people crossbreeding them, since they look so alike that they would actually breed them together. And so it's kind of the two species are actually commingled into one species. Their genetic markers differ very slightly, but it most likely means that evolution and breeding just have changed the nature of the birds so that they could adapt and be used in our current culture today. So by the 1900s, these small birds became popular in Japan for their meat and eggs.
Okay, let's see what we got here. There we go.
Welcome back.
Hey, let me explain something, because I've been doing this for 5 years. This is live radio. It doesn't get any more live than this. There's a 20-second delay, but let me tell you, especially when I'm on the road, book tour, doing events, whatever, it is just really potluck based on sometimes that we're all at liberty of the techno god. So it is not an issue. Don't even worry about it. It happens, I wouldn't say all the time, but it does happen on occasion, and you can't do anything about it because we're live. So no worries. But we're back. That's the important thing.
Well, yes, you guys are getting a radio show from the Quail Lady underneath a tree right now with the best reception there is on the property. So enjoy while it lasts before the phone cuts me off.
Okay. Hey, I have a shout-out for you. Debbie Munsey, I believe, or Munsey? Debbie Munsey says hello to you. She wants to send a shout-out and say hello to you.
Well, hello, Debbie Munsey. I know Debbie Munsey.
Okay. Very good. She says it's almost time for her to get back to work, but she wants to send you a shout-out and say hello, that she listens to you. And she loves to listen to you because she likes it when you get on a when you get on a quail roll. She called it. Boy, there's no stopping you when you get focused and start teaching. She loves it.
Well, that's good to know. Debbie's a good friend of mine. Soon she'll get back into quail. I know she will.
Yep, exactly.
So we have by the 1900s, we got this. The small birds became quite popular in Japan. They're actually really popular today as well for their meat and eggs, and they're getting bigger, which is awesome. They were known as the sing-a-song bird quail strains then, but they did not survive World War II. But they're known as a poor bird, poor songs bird, because of that crow. The males make this really neat crow, the females make a cricket sound, so you would put it in a bird cage and it would be the poor man's songbird, because they aren't very expensive, but still, they make a cool sound. But they start, the sing-a-song quails started back in 1900s, and today people still have them as their aviary birds, but I don't think they're considered as a poor man bird, but in the past, they were using them as that. All stocks of quail in the U.S. seem to be an importation from Japan. I mentioned that before. That's why we have them most popularly called as Japanese quail. They were made by J.W. Steinbeck of Concord, California in 1953. And most of these quail ended up in University of California, UC Davis, from which the Texas A&M strain actually started before they got to Texas A&M University. The glamorous name Pharaoh, used to describe the Coturnix in the United States, is technically not correct because its use should be restricted to the wild Coturnix, but the name has gotten to the normal wild type coloring of the Coturnix regardless of its size as Pharaoh. That's why I call the jumbo wild type the jumbo Pharaohs, because it's a common name that everybody knows about. We don't have standards yet on the quail. I'm hoping that breeders get together, including myself, and we can get on a common goal and figure out these names. But the Pharaoh is the most well-known variety. Currently, we are at a near-threatened status with these Coturnix, the Japanese quail, because they're not found in the wild anymore. People have gotten quite a liking for them. They don't do well out in the wild. They're the domesticated type I talk about. They do well as pets. They do well for meat and eggs. They're not very fast, per se, as bobwhites, and they don't fly very high. They don't roost. They're ground dwellers. So they are in the near-threatened status. They have migrated all over till today, and I'm believing it is because that we have the two species, the wild European Coturnix mingling with the Japanese Coturnix. And but the history of the Coturnix do show us the potential within them. They've been around for so long, and they have many more years to evolve into what we need them to be. But with selective breeding, we can get those jumbos to where we want them. We can get the colors to where we want them. We can treat them like chickens, and we can preserve them so they don't get lost. They are quite valuable birds. I would like to discuss natural history for a little bit with the Coturnix, and you can follow me with Chapter 11 if you have Coturnix Revolution. If not, you can order a copy. There's a code on I'll give the code later, or Andy has the code as well. We have the wild Japanese quail that they live in the grass and they made their nests there. They devoted a majority of their time scratching and foraging. This is why I like enrichment in the Coturnix, because the wild Coturnix do love foraging. So if you provide dust baths, they can forage in the dust bath. You can provide mealworms. You can provide extra protein sources in their dust baths, and they can be more productive. They can lay more eggs with some enrichment in there, less cannibalism, less pecking. We have the Coturnix are most active at night, just like they are today. They're not social creatures other than joining others for a dust bath or when migrating. They fly together at night, but they're separate during the day. I see that with our birds today as well. They do like to be social and they do communicate, but when I feed them, it's each man to its own. You know, eat, drink. If you're in my way, I'm going to beat you up. The Coturnix migrate to northern Japan and Korea about 400 to 1,000 kilometers during the summertime. This is when they raise their young. During the wild Japanese quail used to raise their young. Today, they don't have that ability as much. We do have some cases of broody, which is in my book as well. This is when they raise their young. During the winter, they migrate to China and Taiwan, as well as southern Japan. Their suggested lifespan was 2 years, as tag birds were rarely recaptured. There was a study by Stino, who was at the University of California, Davis, and he was from Egypt, and there is a line in Egypt still with the Coturnix, and he had a whole experiment of recapturing and releasing birds in the U.S., and the oldest bird that he would actually recapture were about 2 years old, so that's how he came up with the two-year lifespan. Now, my oldest bird passed away at 7.5 years old, so in captivity, they can live much older, especially if you have them as pets. The wild males they weighed about 75 grams and the females 80 grams. Today they're about 260 plus grams. So there's a huge markup. The birds' weights after domestication did increase up to 113 grams due to the lack of exercise. Enrichment will change that, however. Change of diet can also do that as well. It was recorded that 80 eggs were laid by a hen in the wild, but with artificial incubation and selective breeding, we have gotten that to 300 eggs per given hen. So everything has changed over the years, but it's still amazing to see that history on how a bird has evolved over the years. It's really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That is a little glimpse on history, because I want to still cover on how Coturnix are important today, what they're used today. But I would like to discuss housing before I get cut off again. There are many types of housing for quail. There are battery cages. You can house them as pets. And I house mine personally in wired floors. I like the battery cages. I don't like the GQS battery cages per se, but I do like wire bottoms with plenty of space to put a dustpan in, which I use a plastic shoebox filled with either oyster shells or dirt. The oyster shells are used as my calcium source so that the birds can forage in there. A few mealworms are added in their alfalfa cubes that are soaked that they can munch on. They like grass. The dust bath is used as their natural habitat, kind of what they can find in the wild to forage in, and I always find eggs laid in there. There are some quail that they're not as smart, and they lay on the wire, but what's nice about the wire flooring is that the eggs stay clean compared to a litter setting. But all are good. I'm going to describe different types of housing. All work. Some take more effort in cleaning than others, but it is all your choice. You know, it's the breeder's choice on what they want to use. I'm not going to say what is the best housing. Because all can work. I've used every single. I still use a deep litter method for some birds, and I use wire on the others. It depends on what I have available at the time being. So I will mention every type of housing that I can come up with and what's in the book. They can be. Coturnix can be housed in many environments. They are not particular to where they can be housed, because they are covey birds. They are happiest in larger groups. Covey means, when I think about covey, I usually think about quads. Coturnix, the Japanese Coturnix, I do one male per every three females. That is my ratio. Some people do pairs, but pairs are not that great because females can be pecked really bad or overbred. And so they don't live as long in stressful situations, and you have to replace them often. Trios work, but a female can be picked more than the other. The male will pick one over the other, and so one hen will be overbred, and the other one will look nice. So I like to have one male per every 3 females as a minimum in my breeding facilities, but it's kind of a trial and error since some males will do better in pairs as others will require more hens. So you just got to watch the behavior of your birds and your environment as well. The male coturnix is referred to the cock, and he needs to be stimulated by more than one hen. So that is why I like the 1-to-3 ratio. With the 1-to-3 ratio, he has more birds to socialize with, and the cock has more hens to mate with. I have some pairs for projects, and they do fine together. Older birds tend to do fine together. Younger birds are more wily, and they need more socialization. The rule of thumb for any housing is at least 1 square foot of space. This is a very small confinement. So if you want more space for your birds, you can do 2 square, 3 square. The more the merrier. But if you want the minimum space requirement is 1 square foot. Too little space will cause health problems and pecking due to boredom. The bigger, the more space you have, the more enrichment you can add. And I'm all for enrichment. Enrichment is amazing. It has really helped big time with production. So you have many choices in housing coturnix. Some house their birds indoors, and others will house them outdoors. I myself house them indoors so that I can control their environment and their lighting better. Outdoors, they will be they will have outdoor sunlight and susceptibility to other issues. So smaller producers will house their birds outdoors since they do produce a significant amount of ammonia due to their fast maturity and size. They do poop a lot, and they do stink if you don't clean them out fast enough. Even though they're small birds, they sure have a lot of waste for being small birds. So whether their cages are indoors or outdoors, the birds do need to be safe from predators. Snakes are a predator. Believe it or not, snakes love quail.
Hello? Did we lose her again? Okay, stand by. Welcome back.
Well, I'm back.
Welcome back.
How much time do I have left?
Let's see. I believe I extended this particular show, so we should be just fine. Let me see if I've got this drop down blocking it. Yeah, I extended your show to 2 hours just in case you needed it, because I can end it at any time. So we've got plenty more time for all of your knowledge.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah, the weather is not liking me today.
Hey, it happens. Not a problem. The information is 100% in grand, and there's a little break every now and then from disconnect. Doesn't matter. We still got a clear connection, and all the information has been clear. That's the important thing.
Well, that is perfect. I was worried that it would cut me off between sentences, and that would be a very annoying
problem. I can hear you 100% clear. Just when you're gone, you're gone. But you come back quick, and all the information you've given has been clear and readable, understandable, no problems, no gurgling, no static. So that's a good thing, especially for the archive, for the folks that listen later.
Wonderful, wonderful. So I'm going, all right, let's start with housing, types of housing. We have ground pens. Ground pens are also known as deep litter pens for coturnix. Some farmers keep their pens on the ground, like poultry in an aviary system. Coturnics used as pets can be used as bottom dwellers and with parakeets, finches, or doves. Do remember that, yes, they like to eat those seeds, but they still need a high-protein diet. So do provide them with their high-protein diet of a 30% game bird starter, unmedicated.
And that's all the time?
Yes.
And that's all the time?
I like to give them 30% protein from start to finish and throughout their whole entire lifetime, even as pets. The minimum protein requirement is 24% if they're not breeding, but I have found that very low protein causes a lot of aggression. So the higher the protein, the better they are mental-wise and physically. Manipro has a 28% protein. Purina has a 30% protein. So there is Southern States. I don't know the percent of Southern States. It has to be between that. There's also, I think, a 24% Manipro perhaps, but I'm not quite sure. But 24% is the minimum. 30%, even higher than 30%, especially during the summer, is wonderful. But I will talk about nutrition in a different section so that I don't go overbound. The ground pen is a natural setting where the birds can be on soft ground, dirt, or sand. But I don't recommend sand is lately not really good because they can ingest it. I've seen many birds ingesting sand, causing crop issues later on. Dirt is a natural. I get a lot of sand and dirt here in Florida, and as long as I add some grit in, you know, especially in the poultry coops, I add lots of grit or rocks. They do okay, but pure sand tends to be very fine and not really good for them per se. I like, if you were to do a natural setting, though, I would add some pine pellets because it will smell over time, especially if it rains and it gets wet. It gets kind of gross. There are, with ground pens, there will be health issues. One is that the bird will lay on the dirt, which will be, you know, the bird. This will be the ground in which the bird also defecates on. So, the eggs can be dirty because it can the dirt can clump on the eggs. So the bacteria can seep on the eggs, causing unfavorable incubation experiences. So you may have to wash the eggs or collect as often as possible or cull eggs if they're really dirty. Also, coturnics have small feet, and the small clumps of dirt can gather around their nails, causing bacteria buildup if the nail is broken. We can also get a condition called bumblefoot, which is a staph infection. But you can fix that with a small incision, hydrogen peroxide, tweezers, or a cup of Epsom salt. I usually, with quail, it's even on wire footing, they sometimes get bumblefoot because you can get sores on your feet sometimes if you don't get off for long periods of time. And in that case, I have a cup and I put the bird in a cup and she just sits there and soaks, and it heals her foot up right away. But
got a couple of questions in the chat room. One a few minutes ago and one very recently. Can all the birds live together in a coop and run males together? I'm getting 50 quail, or do I need individual cages for smaller groups? And then the second question is, do they need a nest box?
Was the question with all males?
Yeah, can all the birds live together in a coop and run, being males? If you have several males, can they all stay together with the females, or is
yes.
it just like a breeding? And then
you can raise, if they're raised together, you can raise them together in a big group. That is fine.
Okay.
I have had, you have to watch the behavior. Some males will be more aggressive than others. There will be a pecking order. What you will notice is that some males will, what it's a, not a nice experience sometimes, is that if you see a male with a sculpted head, remove the poor guy with the bloody head. He was a submissive boy. Put some Neosporin on the head and let him heal in a separate cage, and he may need a few girls for himself. But that's the only way to really separate the birds if something happens. But normally, they should be okay in a big group. You do have to watch behavior, because there will always be somebody that's naughty. And not only males will fight, females can be territorial as well. So anytime you see any pecking, enrichment will decrease the pecking, space will decrease the pecking, higher protein will decrease the pecking, if you do see pecking, just remove the injured bird, or if you see the naughty bird, then he might have to go to freezer camp is what I call it, but take the boy that's bloody, because everybody will start having that behavior. Bloody boy goes out, bloody girl goes out to a isolation cage, Neosporin on head, or Blue Coat. Blue Coat is a good brand, too. And once they heal, give him a couple females or a friend to sit with, and then they'll be your other little cage. As for a nesting box, I use the dust baths as their nesting box, but you can make a little nest box for them as well, like a little box for them to go in, put some hay in, and usually they will use it. Not all will use it, but you should find a few eggs in there. They do like to have secluded areas. I have a lot of quails, so I have the plastic shoe box, and they like to go in there. My budding quail likes to have little tiki huts in their cages. And I always find each pair has their own little house that they go in, and there's always a couple eggs in there. So just know the behavior of your birds, and they do like little hideouts. And a nest box is a form of enrichment, so that is fine. Just no roost. They do not roost. So make it low to the ground, or even a house, like a little house, like a one of those hamster houses that they can go in, or a guinea pig house that they can just crawl right in with some hay. Mine have been having fun with alfalfa hay, because alfalfa is high in protein. So I've been putting that in their enrichment boxes and their dust baths, and they've been having a blast in them. So ground pens are an ideal pen. You do have to watch for worming, and you may have to worm them or give them apple cider vinegar in their water as a natural remedy to prevent things. I don't really have any issues with worming. In fact, I haven't wormed my quail in 4 years because I haven't had any parasites. So prevention is key always. But nest boxes are wonderful. Just don't have any roosts. They rarely go up any ladders. Don't make anything too fancy for them. They like things easy. They're kind of laid-back animals. Some people have off-ground pens with solid ground, and just means that they're like the rabbit hutches with the wire. At Tractor Supply, they have these rabbit hutches or rabbit houses. It's called a chicken hutch, the chicken hutch and run. I got that as my first quail house, and what I did is I put hay on the bottom, hay over the wire, and they love that. It gave them a place to get off the wire and solid footing as well. The bedding can be pine shavings, sawdust. Sand doesn't work very well, but pellets of any kind. The theory behind this method is to get the bird off the ground from the pathogens, but letting the bird show its natural instinctive behavior. Now, any coop with a run, you have to make sure the coop has three sides, because without the three sides, they don't have wind protection, but also with a run, make sure that they can get away from rain, and watch for any that stay out in the rain, because a wet quail is not a happy quail. Rain, I always think of that movie Gremlins. Just don't get them wet. Bad things happen when quail get wet. They pretty much go. They drop out fast, and it's bad. It's just not a good sight. You can lose a whole flock due to a little rain. But it's like, don't let them eat after midnight. You know, don't let them out in the rain. Just bad. But also predators, make sure that run is predator-proof, because raccoons and opossums are notorious. Cats, I've had a cat problem. Dogs, not so much. Digging, maybe. But runs, you just have to be careful with runs. Wired pens off the ground is what I do. Simple aviary cages work for a small breeder flock, but when you get bigger with numbers, they don't really work, especially if the birds get bigger. They kind of dent the wire, so mine have retired. My cages have retired a bit because they're just so dented, it's crazy. Most farmers do choose to house their Coturnix off the ground and on wire. The reasoning behind this method is so no pathogens get into the cage. They are much better suited to growing and laying in cages than outdoor pens or free range. Like I mentioned, once they're free range, you won't have your quail again, because something is going to get it. It's going to camouflage into the grass, or it's going to be gone. In cages, you can control light, temperature, food, and water. And in free range, they're just gone. So the bird lays their egg on the wire, and the egg is clean. But they also have the dustpan that they can lay their egg in their dustpan. If you have the nest boxes, you can train them to go into the nest boxes. Or they'll probably figure out the nest boxes. It's a nice, safe home. And you might have a natural environment that you can get your Coturnix to go broody. I've had several people email me and tell me that their Coturnix are broody or they have raised some chicks. Now, that's amazing, because that instinct has gone away. So it's nice to hear that some people have gotten that natural habitat for them, or that their bird feels so safe that they're actually incubating their own eggs. That is really neat. The only health issues that I have seen with wired pens is the feet of the Coturnix. Some strains, especially the larger strains, develop sores over time on their feet. So that's why I recommend enrichment with those dustpans. Perhaps you put, if you're doing the larger dual-purpose birds for meat and eggs, to have a kitty litter, one of those kitty litter pans, and put the nest box in there so that they can go in the dustpan and into the nest box and get off the wire, because they can get the sores and bend the wire. You might have to have stronger wire when building your cages. Boredom can also result in
I believe she got disconnected again. Let me get back over here to the switchboard. Yep, she did. So we'll go to one more quick commercial break when we come back. Hey, folks, if you're just joining us, we're talking to the Quail Lady. It is all about quail with the Quail Lady, Alexander Douglas. And we still have about 30 minutes left available of the show, so no worries there. But we'll go to one last commercial break, and we'll bring her back, and she'll continue on talking all about quail. Second episode she's been on, and we now are going to have her two times every month. Gotta love it. Stay with us, folks. We'll be back right after this short break.
McMurray Hatchery is the world's oldest and largest rare breed hatchery. They have been providing their customers quality poultry since 1917 and have more than 110 different breeds to choose from. Be sure to sign up for their weekly special email at McMurrayHatchery.com and receive a $5 internet exclusive coupon to use on your first internet order. McMurray Hatchery, the world's largest and oldest rare breed hatchery.
Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your Chicken Fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com.
Hey, it's the Chicken Whisperer, here to tell you that if you have backyard poultry, nothing is more important than making sure your feathered friends are safe from infectious poultry diseases. Learn the simple steps to keep your birds healthy by visiting this website, healthybirds.aphis.usda.gov. That's healthybirds.aphis.usda.gov.
A message from the USDA.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. We'll get back over here to the switchboard and bring the Quail Lady back live. Thank you very much. You're back live again. At least I think you're back live. Hello?
Hello?
Okay. Says that she is live. Let's try this again. Alexander, can you hear me? There. There we go. Now
yep,
you're back.
I'm here.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Okay, good, good. Okay. Welcome back.
Boy. All right. Well, as I was saying with the wired pens, that and it's very important to provide enrichment in them because this is where boredom can result with no instinctual behavior added. The instinctual behavior is very important for added productivity. The birds can dust bathe and look for insects in their dustpans, as you can add anything you want in those dustpans. Yes, they will provide, they will make a mess, but at the same time, you'll make a very happy quail at the same time, too. I love to tell people that enrichment is really needed as an alternative source to prevent these problems, because I do hear many phone calls and emails asking, why did my quail kill the other quail? Well, what does your cage setup look like? What is the size of the cage? What do you have in the cage? How many birds do you have in there? Are you sure that they were two females? You know, it's these questions that need to be answered for me to make a valid answer. You don't need to buy a very expensive cage to start off quail. The rabbit hutches and cages work well for housing coturnics. You can make your own cages with any material. Many people make their own cages to suit their own needs, to fit the space that they have. Just make sure 1 square foot per quail. Many companies sell cages and hutches ready to build. These cages and hutches are not that expensive. Like I said, Tractor Supply, I bought most of my first cages, and they're still working. I had to add a new roof on some hutches, but they're still working. The rabbit cages are wonderful grow-out cages, and I believe that they're $15 to $16 for one cage. You can build one similar and get the tray from Tractor Supply, so that saves some money. We've made some homemade battery-type cage systems, too, that are bigger than a regular GQF system, so that they get their own enrichment. Each of them have their own dustpan in there, so it's about 4 square feet per bird. You can use household supplies that would make household supplies as your quail cages. Myers Poultry Farm in Friendship, Tennessee uses these wired shelf materials, and she made her own quail cage out of those. So that was really neat. Should check out her page, and she can show you what she did. But that was really amazing. I believe they were shoe racks that she put together, and she made a whole huge system for her large Texas A&Ms. As for other quail, you still have to provide them with 1 square foot per bird. And I love enrichment. The word does get annoying when I'm like, enrichment is key, enrichment, enrichment, you know. It gets kind of redundant. But the domestication of quail does not appear to have altered the quail behavior. So you have to design a housing that caters their the most high priority needs that, you know, that they have for scratching, pecking, and dust bathing. So nest boxes, as that one person asked, is a perfect example to meet their high priority needs to prevent bad behavior. Now, the quail housing basics that animal welfare science has evaluated is social housing, the solid floor with pine pellets, the wired bottom floor with enrichment, and opportunities to forage, having a nest box, pecking materials, plenty of pen space, and much more. I'm going to discuss the quail housing basics so that you can have these components in mind when deciding what kind of cage system you want. What I was describing earlier are ways to house your coturnics in, but there are so many different species of quail. Budding quail are preferably, you can raise them in pair cages, and Jody McDonald in California built her own quail cages to suit their needs, but you can they're so small that you can have them in little hamster cages for one pair. That's their basic needs. But for social, the quail in general are social animals, and they should not be singly housed without compelling veterinary or scientific justification. They will form that stable pecking order and hierarchy in captivity. So that's why I have the breeding quad of one male per three females, so that I don't really have a pecking order among males. If you have the larger grouping, you have to watch for behavior. And if you do see some problems, you have to take out the hurt bird so the others don't get that pecking instinct, because it's a monkey see, monkey do aspect in the quail world. If you add new individuals, you have to make sure that you're introducing them slowly by having another cage next to the cage in which you're introducing them to, so that the birds can establish a relationship. Because once you put new birds in there, that pecking order will start, and you can get many hurt birds. Females can be housed in single-sex groups, but they can also have that pecking order as well, and you can see lots of attacks if new members are joined. So you have to treat them as though you're introducing new chicks. Like if you're getting, if you have a breeder pair of chicken and you're introducing juveniles to that group, you have to have a cage within the pen to introduce them slowly. Males should be pair housed, but if they are raised together, they usually do not have a problem unless they have a territorial issue. Breeding birds can be housed in pairs or trios comprising one male and two females. But depending on anyone's situation, you have to do a trial and error with any quail. Budding quails should be paired, and they should be in pairs. Many birds are monogamous, but many birds are also, they should be in coveys, such as coturnics, are, they do best in social groups of coveys. Bobwhites, they do well in pairs or trios. Valley quail and gambles quail do well in groups, but they do form monogamous relationships as well. Foraging is extremely important in the behavior for quail, and that's why I emphasize that enrichment is key to avoid any aggression. So having enrichment in any of your cage setups is important. Recently in our we've been moving our juvenile chicken chicks to different pens for grow outs, and we've been put two different group of ages in there. And what, for some reason, we didn't have any enrichment tools in there. They're on pine pellets at the moment, and we put these little peat moss balls in there, and they just went crazy over them, and they were running around like they were playing soccer with those little peat moss balls. But that made they didn't fight with each other because they were more focused on those little balls and playing soccer. So the next day, all the birds were snuggled together, regardless of their age. So enrichment, I found that keeping their brain stimulated and having enrichment is key. I was so against that Manipro treat thing that you can buy anywhere now. It's this ball, this plastic ball, and inside you, there's this little treat thing. I thought it was such a waste of money, but now as I'm thinking that you can make other things similar to that treat thing, fit in the pen, and the birds will go crazy over it. But enrichment. Foraging, enrichment, dustpans. I do focus, I do emphasize about cover. Quail have a strong preference for cover. They show less flight behavior if they are frightened while under cover. Quail, when frightened, they tend to do this boinking pattern. They bop their head on the top of the cage. The issue behind this is that they can break their necks. Smaller birds, larger birds, larger quail, and the ornamental. And what is most frustrating is when you buy a $100 pair of whatever, and the first night something scares them, and the next day you have two birds with broken necks because they don't have cover. You just, cover is important. Having a roof over their head is very important, and that's why I mentioned no rain, especially the runs, because anything can scare them. You can have other forms of cover, horizontal screens, artificial plants. Some people put old Christmas trees inside the cages. You know, they cut up old Christmas trees and use that as cover. Yeah. Potted grass, stacked hair, straw, and shrubs and outdoor aviaries. Some birds do well when they have areas to hide in. Bobwhites, for example, and other New World quail, if they have shrubs or bushes to hide in, they feel much safer and it's less struggle to hurt themselves. A roof designed to minimize head injuries is very important because that's how they can break their necks, and that's a very frustrating thing with quail. Coturnics do not have as much of an issue because their cages are meant to be short because they are shorter birds and they feel safe in shorter cages because they're they do well in confined space. I mentioned.
Uh-oh, it sounds like we have lost her again. No worries. No worries at all. We'll be back, and I'm sure we'll have no problems with that.
Do you provide a heat source for your backyard chickens in the winter? In most cases, it's not necessary. But if you choose to provide a heat source for your backyard chickens, it's imperative to use a safe and effective heat source, and the only one I recommend is the Sweeter Heater. The Sweeter Heater is a safe, completely sealed, washable, non-breakable, energy-efficient, long-lasting, and reliable specific area heater that comes with a 3-year warranty. Ditch the dangerous heat lamp this season and invest in the only heater I recommend, the Sweeter Heater. Purchase the Sweeter Heater online at sweeterheater.com. That's sweeterheater.com.
All right, Alexandra, you are back in live.
Yes, I am. I would like to mention quickly before the husbandry-related welfare problems of aggression and how to resolve those issues about what you can put into your dustpans. I did mention briefly in other parts of the show about it, but I would like to talk about some little things. In your dustpans, all quail will take a variety of fruit, grains, small seeds, and mealworms. Crickets are also a good source for them to play with. If you don't like to grow your own mealworm farm, when I talk about nutrition, I'm going to talk about invertebrates that you can grow. You can get them dried at Tractor Supply, or I believe Petco has them dried too, and you can put them in your dust bath because some people can be queasy with bugs.
Mm-hmm.
But always give your birds a choice of foods to forage whenever possible. And if you have a deep litter pen or if they're outside, you can scatter the food on the floor, the treats on the floor, or you can mix them with the food that you're giving them, and they will have a ball playing with that. You can present the food in interesting ways so that, it can help with their enrichment, put them in treat balls or, make them work for it if you have them as pets, because many people have coturnics and other birds as pets. So we have to respect everybody's uses for quail. They're not just for meat and eggs. But pet birds are for eggs, so not everybody uses them for meat. Alfalfa cubes are amazing. I have an obsession for alfalfa cubes because it's been hot here in Florida and everywhere pretty much. If you soak them a little bit, the birds just love soaked alfalfa cubes. With pecking materials, the pecking helps with reducing fear with new items and change. When quail are brought to new environments, they stop laying or they get stressed out and get into a molt. By providing anything to peck at, like you can put them in treat balls, or you can make a little... you can put the seeds in the peanut butter ball or something. Give them toilet paper rolls or paper towel rolls to play with, the cardboard part. And you can give them stuff to play in. There is somebody in my Quail Breeders Unite group that has a lot of neat enrichment for his budding quail, cylinders and tubing, and you can see the budding quail playing with those, and it's cute. But... giving them all these opportunities to forage and play helps them from focusing on fighting and trying to mark their territory with each other, because they can get bored, and when they get bored, things happen and it reduces production. And the key for many breeders is that they want production. Now, lastly, before... The second show, which I will discuss nutrition a little bit. I'm going to discuss a little bit. It's getting quite windy. Discuss a little bit more about housing with other species, as well as I'm going to talk about examples of housing and how to build housing, and nutrition, because nutrition is very important and it's a huge topic. I would like to discuss the potential husbandry-related welfare problems and how you can resolve them. One of them is aggression. Aggression can lead to skin lesions, feather loss, and serious injuries. The causes are not always clear. It can be the behavior of the bird. He can just be very aggressive. It can be that they don't like the environment they're in. There is a predator that's bothering them. There is just bad ventilation or other problems. But the risk can be reduced by providing a good quality and quantity of space and ensuring that established groups are not mixed. You can have barriers that can help to diffuse aggression by breaking visual contact between the birds. Budding quails, for example, can get very aggressive. They're very territorial birds, and even though they're very small, man can kill each other. That's why they're known to be paired, because the males will kill each other because they have their mates and they have a really big territory for their area. If, like mentioned before, if you see anybody with blood, remove them immediately, because there's a monkey see, monkey do. There's toe pecking, there's bloody scalps. And if you see that, immediately take them out of the flock. Put some Neosporin on their heads or blue coat. Make sure it doesn't get in their eyes because they'll sting. But quail are fast healers. They once you put anything on their heads or even nothing on their heads, they heal fast. Head injuries is another problem. They're due to escape responses. These can be fatal. They can bounce. They can have that boink effect in the cage. Other than, you know, if they don't crack their neck, they can hit their head really hard. They can go into a concussion, or they can die. The fear can be reduced by providing cover and enrichment. Yes, I said enrichment again. It's just a very important thing, and many people have thought that quail do not need it, but I find it very important. It has really made their quality of life better over these years. You need to make sure that everyone knows how to approach the birds. Wearing the same color clothing is very important. Once I wore red, I usually wear a green or blue tank top, and they're used to my color tank top. And one day I wore a red tank top, and all of them went bonkers on me. I had to change the color of my shirt and walk back in. Another issue was that there was a broom and a trash bag, a black trash bag that I left there, and they start boinking and going crazy. Normally, they're very calm and come towards the cage door, but when I have any changes in that room, there can be an injury. So keep having things the same. They're same birds. They're very habitual. They like things the same. So make sure that the birds have at least 30 centimeters of headroom. The shorter the cage, the better, because if they have very tall cages, they have more of an impact than shorter cages. I mean, it's better to have shorter cages than taller cages because of the impact. Also, injuries can be caused by repeated mating attempts. So make sure that you have appropriate sex ratios before sexual maturity. Now, every species have their own sexual maturity. That's why I went into detail about the origin and word of quail and how misleading it can be, because that's how some issues can result, because people are saying, oh, I have a quail, why is it not laying? Or I have a quail, it's beating each other up and it should be, you know, mature by now, or it's 2 years now, what's going on? So need to know what you have to. Foot problems can occur. And when a bird is very upset, they'll bang their heads, causing more injuries. So you need to take these into consideration. And if you have further issues, sometimes I have to put bubble wrap on the top of the cage until the bird will calm down, or I have to cover the cage at night, because every bird responds to stress differently. And new birds especially will respond much differently than birds that have been used to you. So make sure that you keep things the same, and to introduce new birds slowly. And if you do have an injury, to remove them to isolation so other birds don't have the behavior that you do not want. Behavior frustration is another problem. When there's a behavior frustration, that can be that can result in cannibalism. And cannibalism is not a behavior you want, because what happens is that you're going to lose toes, you're going to lose eyes. Birds will be pretty much beaten to death, and then the birds will start eating each other, and it's the zombie effect. It's really not, you see it in movies, and you only want to see it in movies, not in real life, especially not in your quail populations. This can be avoided by providing nest boxes or good cover and lots of nesting materials. So this is where enrichment comes in key too. So with housing, not only do you have to have a good, solid housing, avoiding predators, you have to have something that your bird will feel safe in and that it will be stimulated in. Yes, they will be stimulated hormonally by the other birds, but they need something that will keep them, that will distract them from picking on each other, because boredom, everybody gets bored. And if you're stuck in a cage or in a coop, you need something to do. So that's where the dust baths come in handy. So dust baths and enrichment, adding those to the quail houses, to their quail pens, will be really good. So that's where I'm going to stop. That's where I'm going to stop today. And next time we're going to talk about nutrition of quail.
That's awesome. Yeah, nutrition is going to be a biggie. And wow, great information. We really covered a lot, and you're just in time. We've got a minute and 50 seconds left of today's broadcast, so that's pretty awesome. And really great overview from a month ago. I want to remind everybody that you've been listening to Alexandra Douglas, of course, all about quail with the Quail Lady today. And she was coming on once a month, but just the amount, as you can hear, today's show is a perfect example, the amount of information that she has, that she wants to share with us, that we need to know if we're going to actually effectively raise quail successfully in our backyard on our homestead. It's something we need to know. So she has agreed to come on twice a month now, and so we're not have such a big gap, and people stay interested, and they're staying, and they're going to follow. Hey, every 2 weeks I need to tune in, and sounds great. She's going just like a college course, the beginning, and going through what everything you need to know next week. As you just heard her state, we've got nutrition, a very important part of the raising anything. So got to love that. Alexandra, thank you so much for coming on today. And very quickly, I've got about 50 seconds. Tell us how folks can follow you on Facebook, Twitter, and website if you've got one.
Well, I'm still working on Twitter, but I'm going to have a whole complete revamped website soon, which is HTTP :// www.stellar-gamebirds.com. Same domain, but a complete different look soon. And there's the Coturnix Revolution book out. You can go on my farm page, which is Stellar Game Birds, Stellar Game Birds Poultry Waterfowl, which I'll post a link on your wall so people can follow. And the new book that's out, there's a link to it on my farm page as well. And so those are the two pages right now that I'm working on, but the farm is growing, and so I have a lot to do.
Absolutely,
so,
and maybe hopefully that farm won't be...
There is always something to do.
Yeah, amen for that. That is for sure. And hopefully the storms today will divert you and won't come your way, so you have to batten down the hatch too much with all your animals there. So thank you very much for coming on another great episode with All About Quail with the Quail Lady, Alexandra Douglas. And we hope that you'll tune in every 2 weeks right here on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. Thank you very much for tuning in.
Ha ha ha.